Isn't it nice to be introduced as a lady? Here comes that falling down drunk that you know. What'll we do with her when she falls down? What'll we do with her when she starts to vomit? Boy, what a delight to be here with you people. I congratulate you. I congratulate the intergroup on 15 years. I'm an intergroup baby, and when I tell you my story, intergroup is very important to me. And I haven't seen a covered dish buffet like this in years. We've gotten so big down in South Florida that we have everything catered, and it's tasteless, and it's all covered up on silver dishes. And we pay a lot of money for it. The only advantage is we don't have to clean up afterwards. But I think that's part of the fellowship, is cleaning up afterwards. My name is Harriet Rawls. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Coral Gables group. I live in Miami, Florida. I have just set my timer for 2 hours and 15 minutes. If you finish before I do, let me know. I want to thank Janice for calling me and inviting me, and when she did, she called me about 9 o'clock in the morning, and since I've retired, I'm a night person, and 9 o'clock in the morning is a little early for me. And I said, I really don't know how I'm going to handle that. I don't know how to get there. I don't drive that much anymore. And I said, I'll think this over and see how I can get there, because I'd love to come, Janice. And so I kind of went back to sleep, and then I got up, and about 11 o'clock I was reading my paper and drinking coffee. My phone rang again. It was another lady who said, I hope I haven't called too early, knowing my habits. And I said, no, I've already been awakened at 9 o'clock, and I told her who and why she had called us, but I don't know how I can get there. And it was Dot M, and Dot says, I'm going up that way that particular Friday, and I'll take you. And it worked out just beautifully, and she's coming back for me tomorrow. We're going back to Miami tomorrow. I want to thank Janice not only for calling me and inviting me, but for her hospitality. She's apologized 10 times for having to be here instead of with me, but this is where she belongs, and she knows it, and I know it. I know she's one of the hard workers. And she and Jim took me out for dinner last night. We went 3 different restaurants, but we ended up at a wonderful barbecue. So I want to thank them both for being such good hosts and hostess. And today I met Linda and Scott and had breakfast with them, and they were so wonderful to me. Linda is doing a wonderful job, as I understand it. But I particularly want to thank Jim B., your intergroup secretary. I called the intergroup office after Janice had called me, and I didn't have her phone number. So I talked to Jim, and Jim was so welcoming and warm over the phone, and he's been great to me this weekend, so I want to thank all of them. And so that's all the thanks I'm going to do. Thank you for all of you for being here. The young man who picked up the ribbon for 3 days of sobriety, and there are a lot of people with less than a year of sobriety here. I want to talk to you. You know, we talk about the disease of alcoholism, and the Big Book tells us that we can recover from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. It doesn't tell me that I have recovered from alcoholism. I still am an alcoholic. I still have the ism. I'm an ick with an ism. That's the way they talk in treatment centers. They tell me. I've never been to one. And they didn't have them when I got sober. They didn't have them. That's hard for you young people to believe, but that's true. So we talk about the disease. And I like to explain to the young people that if you separate that word, hyphenate it, with dis-ease, most all of us were uncomfortable with self. We were not at ease. We were dis-eased. And yet I know that tonight, sitting here with 3 days sobriety, 6 days, 15, whatever, you are comfortable, you are at ease, because you're amongst people who understand you. And this is so wonderful about coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. We know you. The moment you walk through the door and you say, I have a problem with alcohol, I'm an alcoholic, we know you, and you should know us. because we are alike. And once we start to accept the principles of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't have to ever have to be uncomfortable. We don't ever have to drink again. Those of you who are in this room tonight with less than a year of sobriety, and you with 3 days, darling, you don't ever have to pick up another drink. Now, you may. We're not going to stop you. You don't even have to tell us. We won't know, but you will. You will know. But you don't have to tell us. We hope you don't. Some of us who have longer-term sobriety may drink again, too. And in our case, maybe we'll die because we've gotten a little older. Not much, but a little. I love being sober. 41 years has gone by very rapidly for most of the time. But like any kind of living, it hasn't all been happy, joyous, and free. The book says God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. It doesn't guarantee it. Sure doesn't. Because in 41 years or 4 weeks or 10 days, you can have a lot of things can happen that are not happy, joyous, and free. Because what Alcoholics Anonymous 12 Steps tells us is how to live through life, how to conduct ourselves so that we can face things head on without having to pick up a drink. Now, I can't talk about drugs and things like that because I don't know anything about it. So I'm strictly an alcoholic. Pure as the driven snow. But it tells us in the foreword to the first edition, and of course as it appeared in 1939, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women. Look here tonight, when we have over 200 right here, and at that time there were just 100 that they knew of. Although I love the story, and I think it's pretty true. When Bill Wilson, our co-founder, was counting up and they were trying to get the book written, this wonderful book that we refer to as the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the Big Book. And they were trying to get it written, and they were counting up to see how many were sober. And after a certain length of time, and somebody said, oh, there must be about 50 of us. And someone said, oh, no, it's more like 60. And pretty soon someone got to about 90, and Bill says, oh, what the hell, let's call it an even 100, you know? I met Bill Wilson one time. I just shook his hand. I didn't know him. He didn't know my name. But he was a tall man that was over 6 feet. And he was long-legged, smoked incessantly, which, of course, he died from emphysema. But Bill Wilson was a friendly man. When he shook my hand, I felt the friendship and the love. But he loved to talk. And if you interrupted him, he'd better be on the same subject. If you wanted to change the subject, you'd get out of his way. He must have been a great guy. But he said, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered from this hopeless state of mind and body is what this book is about. We don't recover from alcoholism. We once, with 3 days sobriety and all these young people here tonight with less than a year, you have hope. You have hope because you see 41 years. Over here is a man named Bob. He has 41 years tomorrow. Stand up, Bob. 41 years tomorrow. I was born in Pennsylvania, of northeastern Pennsylvania. I'm an only child. A lot of us are. And there's a pamphlet called the Jack Alexander article from the Saturday Evening Post, which put Alcoholics Anonymous really on the map. And in that article that was written almost 60 years ago, Jack Alexander wrote that. He said, a lot of these people are only children. If not the only child, they're the oldest or the youngest or the favored child, something about us in a family. Sometimes more than one in one family. But many of us are only children, which accounts for all that selfishness, self-centeredness, and all that business. And yet I wasn't spoiled, I don't think, as badly as some children. My daddy doted on me. I was daddy's little girl. But there was reasonable discipline. My mother was a disciplinarian. And my father got me anything I wanted within reason. I had a good schooling, Both my parents wanted me to have good schooling. My mother had been a college graduate back in those early days, in the 1900s, when not all women were privileged to go to college. My mother did. My father was one of those young men who had to support his family. He was the oldest of a large family, and he had to go to work and had nothing more than a high school, not even equivalent of a high school education. So each in their own way wanted me to have an education, and I got a good one. Private schools and private tutors and living in dormitories with other little girls and pretty dresses to wear to fraternity dances and nice, all nice things. My father gave me my own car when I was 15 years old, and I didn't even have a driver's license to drive it. I came home from college in January, my freshman year, and Daddy arranged with the local police to set up a special time for me to get my driver's license. And I drove it back to Washington, D.C., where I was in college. Big girl on campus, I'll tell you. I had all the dates I could handle because I had the only car on campus. there was nothing abnormal about me, except that at the age of 9, my parents had taken me to a local restaurant late at night after their bridge game. They played a lot of cards. And oftentimes, about 11 o'clock at night, they'd say, "Oh, come on, let's cut out the card game and go down to Ray Hoddle's and get a lobster." And we lived sort of out in the country, but it was country in those days, and they had to take me along because they couldn't leave me alone. And so I'd sit up at the table at midnight with the big folks, and eat steamed clams and broiled lobster and all that good stuff. And I remember this one time, someone put a little glass of brown stuff in my hand and said, "Drink this, it will help your indigestion." And I did not know I had indigestion. But I was an obedient child, and I drank it, and I made a face, and I wiped that white stuff off the top of my upper lip, and I felt good, and I wanted more. I wasn't 9 years old. I was suddenly 19. I was the belle of the ball. I was a grown-up. I was sophisticated, and I wanted more of what it was. I suppose it was beer, ale, whatever. I was instant alcoholic. Now, I didn't fall down drunk under the table, believe me, but I never forgot it. And not too long ago, I was reading a book about alcoholism and treatment thereof, and one of the sentences says, "If you remember your first drink, you're probably alcoholic." So I'm probably alcoholic. When I was a few years older, I began to listen to my parents' conversations about the parties they were going to, and whenever alcohol was mentioned, my ears always perked up. And I had my second drink as medicinal purpose again. I had the measles, and the doctor prescribed a little port wine. My daddy didn't know what a little port wine was, and he brought the bottle and put it right by my bed. Sometime later, he came back to check on me. The bottle was half gone. I was all the way gone. And I vomited, I puked, I came to, and I said, "Wasn't that good?" There's a line in Dr. Bob's story in the book, and I love it because it fits me. Bob says, "I just loved my grog." And that was me. I just loved my grog. There was no reason for me to drink. I wasn't inferior, superior, but I was uncomfortable. I was not at ease. I had that dis-ease even as a child. A child of privilege, a child of good background, of good family, a loved child. There was nothing wrong with my background at all, but I was not comfortable. Dis-ease. And it took Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to make me feel part of the world and be comfortable. I'm still not overly comfortable when I'm away from Alcoholics Anonymous people. I'm comfortable in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You get me out there in the real world and I want out. I had to go through it because I was prepared to earn my living, and I made out okay, and I did well, and I was able to help some people along the way. In fact, I've worked for a very large company, and after I got sober and came to Miami, and they knew that I was a member. I'm not anonymous at the public level, of course I am, but within my own friendship and my job, I was not, and I was often asked to take people to meetings, which I never got anybody sober, But I took them to meetings. And when the United Fund, I think it was, came around to the personnel office and said, you people really need to have an alcoholism counselor here. You know it's getting to be the thing. They said, we don't need you. We've got Harriet. So they never got an alcoholism counselor. But in any event, I went off to college when I was 15 years old with my car and graduated when I was 19. And I look back on those days with much pleasure in most of the ways. And yet I can't, I have several serious suitors. You know, in college you sometimes make affairs of just for the fraternity dance, so you take somebody to the junior prom or this or that. But several of my classmates made lasting marriages, and I had opportunities to marry some very nice young men. And I look back and say, why didn't I marry them? Well, I just seemed to know that I wasn't the kind to settle down. I knew it. And it was part of my alcoholism that knew that I didn't fit. Of course, I was in a college that was Methodist, and most of them were going to be Methodist ministers, and I knew that was not for me. I would have wrecked the whole bishopric. And my senior year at the senior prom, or maybe it was the junior prom, I don't really remember, maybe it was both, but we'd go out at intermission time, and this is in 1935, 1936, the height of the big depression, and there was still prohibition going on. Prohibition, I know some of you don't even know what that was, but what it was the law of the land that you couldn't buy legally any alcoholic beverage, and you had to bootleg it. And how these young college students got a pint or two, I've no idea today, but we would have a pint at intermission time, and there'd be four of us usually, two in the front seat and two in the back seat, and as soon as somebody produced that bottle, I began to shake. And when it got to me, and the cork came off, or the top came off, and I smelled it, I calmed down. I was going to get a drink. And it would go down, trickle down, and I would begin to relax. And I was home free, and I began to be comfortable, at ease again. And then we'd go back into the dance, and I'd be dancing with Tom back there. I'd be dancing with my old friend Tom. And all of a sudden, I turned around, and my goodness, I'm dancing with Dick. And at the time, I was 17, 18 years old. I graduated when I was 19. And I said, what happened? Did the music stop? I don't remember the music stopping. And the dances were like 3 minutes long. How could I be dancing with Tom and then with Dick? And it wasn't until 30 years later, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew I'd had a blackout when I was 19 years old. It wasn't long, but it was enough to get that difference. Then I graduated from college and I moved back up to Pennsylvania for a few and began to run with an older crowd. And by older, I mean they were, so sophisticated at age 25. I was 19 and a kid. And these were sophisticated people. And I began to be able to hold my liquor. And they'd say, who's going to drive us home tonight? We'd go dancing up in Scranton. And we had to go home down to Wilkes-Barre, where most of us lived. And they'd say, who's going to drive home from Scranton? Look at Harriet. She's got a hollow leg. She can handle it. Look at her, she's still sober, midnight. Everybody else was drunk and Harriet was sober. She can drink like a man. And my father thought that was a great compliment. To this day, I don't even know what it means. So I had that period where I could hold my liquor, the hollow leg syndrome. And I thought, you know, this is a symptom of alcoholism. The blackouts, this is being able to handle it and then not being able to handle it, never being able to predict. Never being able to predict. You start out in the evening and you're going to have a wonderful time. You like the guy you're with, the great crowd. You love everybody. You're just having a grand time. All of a sudden, plop, you're on the floor drunk. You know, my dates would say to me, you know, he says, you're really a good date when you don't drink so much. And so the next time we'd go out and we'd sit up at the bar and I'd be not drinking. And I'd be sulking. And I'd sit there with that long face. And my date, about 10 o'clock, he'd say, oh, for God's sake, take a drink. Okay, good. party time. I was working for the government as a civil servant employee. I was working for the Quartermaster Corps, and then in Philadelphia. And it was where alcohol began to dictate my whole life. Alcohol told me who to date, how to go, they told me when to go to work, as a matter of fact. I used to miss work on Mondays and Tuesdays. I take off early on Fridays, get back maybe Tuesday or Wednesday. But alcohol dictated everything I did. And then in 1941, we moved over to the quartermaster school, and the quartermaster school moved to Petersburg, Virginia, and in December of 1941, Pearl Harbor was bombed, and we were in World War II. And my absenteeism began to be reprimandable. Up until that time, they'd kind of laughed it off, and they knew where I was, because I've associated with the young officers. And the parties were at the officers' clubs and the swimming pools and the good times. Let the good times roll, as it were. And that makes me think of Bobby over in Lafayette, Louisiana. Let the good times roll. And wartime came along. I thought it was a big movie. I was oblivious to the seriousness of the situation. Here's Pearl Harbor bomb, people dead, and ships sunk, and World War II is going on. I'm flitting around like it's a big play just for me. And I started missing work as usual. One day my boss came in, he said, "Do you think you could type more than one page today?" I'd look in the wastebasket and all these crumpled up pieces of paper, because my fingers wouldn't go right. And I filed, and I couldn't find anything after I filed it. And so I decided I'd better get out of that situation. I looked over the different uniforms. The WACS had been formed, the Women's Army Auxiliary Army Corps. And they're terrible uniforms, really. If you're going to join something, you got to look good, right? So I didn't want to be a WAC. And I looked over all the other uniforms, and I decided I wanted to be a Lady Marine. I liked their uniform. The Lady Marines wore olive drab. But what was gorgeous about it was they had a red ascot tie. That was the whole thing. I could have gone down to Woolworths and bought a red ascot tie. And they had a cap with a red silk cord around it. And when the morning came that I just couldn't make it to work, and I knew that was the day they were going to demote me, they were going to put me in the stenographic pool, and I couldn't stand that. This is the ego of the alcoholic. I was secretary to the colonel, and they weren't going to put me in any pool, you know. They're not going to demote me all the way down to the bottom, as it were. And so I knew I'd found out somehow where to go in Richmond. And I went to Richmond by bus, and by the time I got there, I needed a drink very badly. But I didn't want to drink because I didn't want to smell. I probably already did smell, but I was going to be patriotic and join the Marine Corps. And I found a place in some building, and I've signed a lot of papers. And I had to hold my hands pretty steady because it was shaking. And I was concentrating on that. And the man is asking me questions. And pretty soon I raised my right hand. And I swore to something. And then he shook my hand. He shook my hand and said, "Welcome to the United States Navy." So there I was. I wore navy blue for 3 years. Not only that, but they sent me to officer candidate school, made me an ensign. Then they promoted me to lieutenant junior grade. What kind of navy do they have, anyway? They put me in the supply corps. And I had objected to this. I didn't want to be an officer. He said, "You'll make us a fine officer. Look at this education." I said, "Oh, yeah, oh, yeah." So with all this fine education, they sent me to supply school, and became a supply officer. And they assigned me to an ammunition depot. And we wonder why we lose wars. Well, fortunately, the supply corps handles the ammunition after it's used up. We only had one explosion on base while I was there. I had nothing to do with it. But the most important thing that happened during that tenure, I was assigned to several warehouses. They gave me a Jeep to use as my own vehicle. They assigned me 8 seamen to do the actual labor. They gave us a pickup truck, and then they assigned to us a forklift truck. And when I had the martini lunches, I was the one that drove the forklift. We wore very, very short skirts in World War II. And I'm up there on my forklift with the forks going up and down, going around corners on two wheels and having the time of my life. And my seamen are on the floor laughing and having a wonderful time. They hadn't seen such a good act since sliced bread. They were wonderful. Until one day, it didn't take long. One day, I heard one of them, Cece. It took me a long time to remember what we called him. I knew it wasn't a real name. We called him Cece. And I heard him muttering and supposedly whispering, but he was whispering loud so I could hear him. And he was saying, "What's the matter with her? What's got into her? She talks like us. Where'd she learn that kind of language? She used to be such a nice lady. Listen to her." And see, what I heard was what I already knew. I knew inside of me that I was changing from a fairly nice, well-educated female lieutenant to a drunken woman. And I knew it. And I was using the language, the foul language, the words. I should have been in jail several times, but because I was a woman and an officer in the United States Navy, they took me home or saw that I got home. And I didn't like what I was seeing. Now I saw that other people could see it. And it got worse because now I didn't have to pretend that I didn't know. I was on the way down the hill and I didn't know it. But I had a lot more to go. I got out of the Navy without too much trouble, thank God, because people covered for us. World War II, it was almost like the fellowship. We cared about one another. We might not always like each other, but we loved each other and tried to protect each other. And I got out of the Navy and I saw a sign recruiting. And then I went over to North Africa, Algiers, just a place for a lady drunk to go. They had just gotten out of North Africa. We moved into the hotel while General Eisenhower was moving out. And that's where I met my Arab. My Arab was not any just any old fellow. He was a chieftain. You've seen him on television, or people like him. He was a Kaid. Now the Kaid is like the mayor of Leesburg. And he was the Kaid of an oasis called Busada. And I went out to the oasis of Busada and we rode our camels into the Sahara. Don't tell me you can't get drunk in the Sahara Desert. And the State Department came knocking on the tent door. Time to go home. And we rode those camels back into Busada, and my Arab, and I wish I could remember his name. He was wearing a garment called a burnoose. Burnoose is a cape like affair with a hood on it. I was wearing my Navy raincoat. I wanted the burnoose and he wanted the raincoat, you know. Now I have to tell you, this is the way I remember it. Maybe nobody knocked on the tent, but I know that they sent for me somehow to get me home. So we traded garments and I'm wearing the burnoose, and of course the State Department sent me home. But they sent me home on a lovely liner, and I wore my burnoose as an evening wrap. And by this time I thought I was the Mata Hari of World War II. I was a spy. And I would wear my burnoose and I would wrap it around me, you know, and I'd peer out over it. I lurked in corners and and I would pounce. I don't know what happened to that thing. When I got home, I was called to task by the Central. I worked for Central Intelligence Agency. I tell you, and you think they're screwed up. This is many years ago, and they're still screwed up. And they asked for my resignation. They fired me. And I left there, and I headed for Florida. I had married in the meantime. A whole story by itself is my trip through Italy, where I met a merchant marine captain whose purser had appendicitis, and so the captain signed me on as purser of a Liberty ship called the Fred Joyce, and I sailed across the Atlantic Ocean, the only woman on a Liberty ship, and I was the purser, and I was all up in the mainmast and down in the bottom. It was a wonderful trip. I had a ball. But the crew court-martialed their captain, my boyfriend, for having his girlfriend, me, on board. Well, he came through okay, and he didn't lose his license, but by golly, I married him. Ridiculous marriage, two drinking drunks is what we were. Alcoholic, yes. So in order to divorce this man, I came to Florida. I read a Farmer's Almanac. It's such a wonderful source of information. And this particular list listed places where you could get a quick divorce. So I came to Florida. And I landed up in by train in Jacksonville in 1955, the fall. It was about August or September of 1955. And I made a phone call to Miami. My cousin Pauline lived in Key Biscayne in Miami. And Pauline knew something about my history, of course, from my parents and her parents. And she, in turn, picked up the phone and called Jacksonville and asked for a phone number for Alcoholics Anonymous. And they gave her the number of the San Marco Clubhouse. And there were two ladies there when that call came in. One was called Pat and the other was called Dina. And they said, "We will go on this 12-step call." And Pat and Dina came to my bedside in a hospital, in a hotel room. It was a second-rate, or maybe a third-rate hotel, right next to the old railroad station in Jacksonville. It was right next door, practically, one of the dumps. And they saw how sick I was, and they arranged for hospitalization for me. And they began to take me to meetings. But when they sat by my bedside, Pat was so beautiful. She was wearing a white dress and white shoes and a hose. There was not a spot on her shoes or her dress, and there were no runs in her hose. And she had on her makeup exactly the way it was supposed to be. Her lipstick was on her lips, and her eyebrow pencil was on her eyebrows. Her nails shone with a fresh manicure, and her hair shone with cleanliness, and she smiled and said, "I'm an alcoholic." Oh! Like many people, I knew Alcoholics Anonymous was a nice place. I knew that. I didn't think it was a bunch of bums. I knew better. Well, and Dina said the same thing. "My name is Dina. Now I'm an alcoholic." And she was just as pretty in her way. One of the things I had seen when we were in... What am I doing? Get out of there. When during the Navy days, we always had a lot of first-run movies. And we went to the Marine Barracks. And a bunch of us went to the Marine Barracks one night for the first-run movie. And the group that I was with were probably about eight of us, and they sat through that movie nudging and chuckling all through the movie, and I sat there petrified. Petrified was right. The movie was Ray Milland in The Lost Weekend. And I knew that man. And I knew that that was me, and I understood that. The Lost Weekend still plays occasionally on AMC, Movie Classics, and if you haven't seen it or get the chance to see it, I see it every time it comes around. And I sit there and I shudder because it was so well done. And I was at that stage, that Lost Weekend, when he hangs the bottle out the window and it's going down, and he hides it in the chandelier and he can't find it, and you see it, and then the mouse comes out of the wall. Oh, it's a marvelous movie. And so these two ladies came and they took me to a couple of meetings. And you put your arms around me, and I kind of stepped back. I didn't know what to make of that. And Pat had a pretty new car, and I smelled so good. And I sat in the back seat by myself, and a crowd, I didn't want to soil. I was dirty, see. I was dirty for a long time, and I took showers, and I took baths, and I was dirty, and I didn't want to soil her beautiful new car. And I didn't want to make you dirty when you put your arms around me and said you love me and come back, because I was dirty, and I didn't want to make you dirty. And it took me a long time to realize that that guilt and that terrible condemnation to myself and that dis-ease that I talk about was eating me up. And I couldn't get at ease and comfortable because I didn't understand anything yet. But I knew that there was a place for me if I could just give up. But I still was hopeless. I still was hopeless. But I didn't understand that this illness could help me. I didn't know that. It would help you, yes, but not me. And they saw how sick I was, and they sent me up to the Veterans Hospital in the South Carolina. Salisbury, North, one of the Carolinas. I don't know. I was sick. And I expected to have a suite of rooms because I had had a friend in Bethesda Naval Hospital in Washington, D.C., and they gave him the suite up there, and he was an admiral. And I was only a J.G. lieutenant, but I thought I'd have a private room. They locked me up. The first week I was there, they put me in the violent ward, Ward D. And I'd be sitting and talking to someone, and all of a sudden she would fly off the handle and grab my hair and pull my hair. And the nurses would grab her and take her over to the rubber room, and she'd come out later with a straitjacket and walking like a zombie. I'd play bridge with three other women, and all of a sudden the whole thing would go up and smoke. The 52 cards would go all over the place. If you'd never played bridge with three other dummies, you know, you'd missed a lot. But I saw these women go into the shock treatments, and I saw them go into the rubber room, and I saw them come out traumatized. And once in a while, their family would come and take them home for a day or two. Sometimes they'd come back within the hour because they couldn't stand it outside. Years later, not too many years ago, I was speaking up in that area, and a man came up to me with pressed his card into my hand, and he's the director now there at that hospital. And he said, some of those women are still there. I said, I know. I knew they would be there forever. And I think, thank God I was allowed out. Thank God I could go. I wasn't put there. I went there voluntarily. My friends escorted me and got me in, but I went there voluntarily. But these are women who will never leave that mental ward, and that Ward D. That's the worst ward. I was only there a week, but I went up to Ward A. I've never found out yet what's in B and C. I don't know. I don't think I want to know. But in Ward A, I became very well known because I was competing over on the ashtray exhibition. I made very good ashtrays in OT, occupational therapy. I also made a fine leather belt that I gave to my psychiatrist. I was not very athletic, but they let me set pins in the bowling alley. I had a wonderful time. I was King Herod for the Christmas play. And the big excitement on Christmas Eve was when two of our shepherds escaped. That was December of 1955. And some of those folks in Jacksonville were corresponding with me, Pat and Dina. And I remembered the faces of some of those men and women who had tried to 12-step me. And one of them I just heard this weekend has died, Pappy Noseworthy. Pappy had been a delegate panel, 8 I think, one of the early panels. But he was one of those that tried to help me while I was there in Jacksonville. I have a very soft spot in my heart for the North Floridian and the area level, because I know a lot of them. During that last month, that December, I took what the big book calls a solitary self-appraisal. I sat in those day rooms and said, what am I doing in a place like this? What's a nice lady like me doing in a place like this? And the book also says that solitary self-appraisal usually is not sufficient. But I did do it in great detail. And I knew that my problem was alcohol, and that when I left there, I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was beginning to realize that was the only place for me. On January the 9th, they discharged me. It was a Monday morning. 1956. I was coming up on my 39th birthday. On Saturday, January the 14th, I would be 39 years old. You just heard that I'm sober 41 years sober, so now you can start adding on your little fingers and toesies. If you do it right, it will come to 80. I was just 80 years old last January. But more importantly, on my 80th birthday, I became 41 years sober. That's the important thing. And so I left that hospital on Monday, January the 9th, and I picked up a bottle. I literally do not remember doing it. So when the newcomer tells me they don't remember picking up the last drink, I believe them because I don't remember picking it up. I don't remember much about drinking it, but I sure remember getting sick on the train, going from Jacksonville to Miami. And I was sick all going down there, and I began to cry. And between crying and going down to the end of the car to get water out of that terrible container they had on the trains in those days, it was warm water with some kind of chlorine or something in it. And you had to pull out a little cup, out a flat cup, and you had to open that flat cup up and put it under the thing and push a button, oh, with two little hands, and one of the hands had a bottle of whiskey in it. So I had to use my teeth, and I'd cry because I couldn't get it all done at one time. It's just terrible, and it was awful, and I can remember to this moment how hard it was to get that damn drink. And we landed in, I say landed because I landed so many airplanes since, but we didn't land in trains. We pulled into the station, and I got off that train, and I had left in my bottle some vodka. Is that for me? And I have an hour and a half left yet. I couldn't fasten my skirt. I had a great big old safety pin, and I was wearing arch preserver shoes. I fell down a lot, and I had a theory that if you wore very heavy shoes, you wouldn't fall down so much. It seems to me I was standing at a little table, something like this one, and I had a drink in my cup, and I had the rest of the bottle, and it was my birthday. It was about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I had my hand on that cup. And I said, please, God, no more. And something happened. And you know what it was. It was the gift of sobriety. It was the hand of God. It was a spiritual experience. It was a spiritual awakening. I was relieved of the desire to drink. Desire. It's not a wish of water, a wish I had. It's a desire. I have to have sobriety. I have to give up this alcohol. And that happened on 6 o'clock on January the 14th, on my 39th birthday. And later, when I looked up on my birth certificate, I had been born on January the 14th at 6:15 a.m. I had been reborn on my natural birthday, and I never had to take another drink. Never. Occasionally, I have thought about a cold lemonade with a little gin in it, you know? I love frozen daiquiris. I love those Tom Collinses. And in hot Miami, you think about that. It's like cigarettes. Once in a while, I think I'd like to have a cigarette on Sunday morning with a paper. But it's just like the book says. I recoil from it like a hot flame. I think about it and I say, whoo, boom, hot flame. I know better. God has given me the grace of understanding. Not everything. I don't understand everything. I don't want to understand everything. But I understand my alcoholism. And I got off that train, and my cousin came and got me. And she had a birthday cake for me. She knew it was my birthday. And oh, my God, when you're just getting off a drunk and they hand you a piece of cake with thick icing on it and pink. Oh. But she was good to me. She was a nurse. She understood a little bit about it. And they saw to it that I got to my meetings from Key Biscayne. At that time, there were no AAs that we knew of on Key Biscayne. Today, they have three thriving groups. At that time, there was only one man. His name was Bill Frost. And he came and took me to meetings. And he took me on my first 12-step call. He took me to all the different rooms around Miami and introduced me to people and introduced me to the different club rooms that we have and different groups. And then one day we went up to a house on Key Biscayne and he stopped the car and he'd been laughing. He'd laughed a lot. And all of a sudden I was laughing and he wasn't. And I looked over and he had his head down on the steering wheel. And he was praying. And I said, "What's going on, Bill?" And he says, "We're going in to see this lady. She's got a problem. She's asked for help." And he said, "I'm praying that we can help her. I'm praying that we'll say the right thing." And we went in and called on this lady, Janet. And I just listened and I heard him talk to her. And I saw her face change as we talked. That was my first 12-step call, and I'd been sober, been dry. I was dry for a long time, fellows. You don't get sober in 3 days. You stop drinking, get undrunk, you dry out, and pretty soon you begin to catch on to the steps that this is how we begin to live. We live by putting these principles into our lives. And the principles are 12, and they're very well worded. Don't try to put them into one-word virtues. There's no such thing. The big book never tells you what the principles are. They say, these are the principles. First, we admit we're powerless over alcohol, but our lives have become unmanageable. That's a principle right there. Surrender. In the first step in the 12 and 12, it says, the principle that we shall have enduring strength. Oh, I got to say that. I got to. It just came out. The principle that we shall find no enduring strength until we first admit complete defeat is the main taproot from which our whole society has sprung and flowered. Our whole society is founded on surrender, on complete defeat. Bill Wilson was completely defeated when he saw that spirit enter his room, that spiritual experience, the nightmare, whatever he had a complete defeat. And Bob Smith had to go through the same thing, to complete defeat. He had to drink again. And upon those two defeats, we have the enduring strength of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to have that complete defeat, that complete surrender, and this from which our society has sprung and flowered. It tells right here, and I've opened up to another thing that I love to talk about. This is from a Grapevine article back in 1960. And it's in the little book called As Bill Sees It. It's called Three Choices. And it's important to me, and I hope to the newer people in Alcoholics Anonymous here in this room tonight. And it says the immediate object of our quest is sobriety. That's what we want first, just to be sober, to be undrunk and to get sober. There's a difference between being undrunk and being sober. Freedom from alcohol and from all its baleful consequences, and without this freedom we have nothing at all. Paradoxically, though, we can achieve no liberation from alcohol obsession until we become willing to deal with these character defects which have landed us in this helpless condition. And in this freedom quest, we are always given three choices. A rebellious refusal to work upon our glaring defects can be an almost certain ticket to destruction. I never had any problem with that. I knew I had problems. I knew that I was uncomfortable. But so many people say, well, there's nothing really wrong with me except I drank too much. Excuse me, I said that once at a women's meeting. I did. They said, how are you doing with your defects? I said, nothing wrong with me. I just drank too much. Whew, did I get the comeuppance from them? We have to deal with those character defects. And almost certain, or perhaps for a time, this is what got to me, and I hope it will to you. Perhaps for a time, we can stay sober with a minimum of self-improvement and settle ourselves into a comfortable but often dangerous mediocrity. I was there for a long time, boys and girls. I took a very mediocre. I did the steps. I got into traditions. I was sober. I was doing meetings, chairing meetings. I was doing everything I was supposed to do, but it wasn't too exciting. Mediocre. And who in Alcoholics Anonymous, what sober alcoholic wants to be mediocre in anything? You know, did you have a mediocre dinner here tonight? No, sir. You had a super. And those desserts, oh my God. And then it says, finally, we can continuously try hard for those sterling qualities that can add up to fineness of spirit and action, true and lasting freedom under God, the God of our understanding. I've had good sobriety. I married very quickly I was sitting at the bar, coffee bar at the old Anana Club, and a young man came up. No, he was sitting at the bar. And I came up and I said, "Is that stool taken?" The one right next to him. And he said in his lovely southern accent, he said, "Honey, it's reserved just for you beautiful lady like you." I'm easy. I married him. Bob couldn't stay sober. He told me he'd been around the program for 16 years. Now, that was in 56, which meant that he got sober before Bill Wilson. But I was new, and I believed him because he was cute and handsome, and he had a southern accent. And so I married him. He had never been sober more than, well, he'd just gotten off of one drug right then. But he stayed sober about 9 or 10 months, and I thought, I'll fix him. You know, that was in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what they did to drunks. They fixed them. Instead of going out on a 12-step call, they would get a phone call. Well, we'll go fix him. Well, I tried to fix Bob Rawls. Well, I couldn't fix him. And I started to divorce him 2 or 3 times, and finally I did. And he died of alcoholism. And in the meantime, he married his drinking companion, who was also a member of AA. She sobered up, and to the best of my knowledge, she's never had another drink. But he kept on drinking and pilling. At that time, the Milltown was our big thing. Lots of Milltown, and God knows what else he got. But it killed him. And he wasn't old. And he loved this program. But he couldn't admit to, I don't think he ever did a real four-step. I don't think if he ever, as someone said over the weekend, what's the point in doing a four-step if you haven't done the first? The surrender, that complete surrender. And so I say to you, under a year of age right now, a year of sobriety, concentrate on those first 3 steps. Surrender. Turn your life over to the care of a power. Turn it over to AA. That's what I did. I turned it over to a group of men and women that I sat with it every day and listened to them. I did very little talking. And then the whole point of this thing, I was sober about 6 months when they said, "You're going to be the intergroup representative." I said, "Okay, what do I do?" And they said, "You go to the intergroup meeting once a month, and then you come back and tell us what happened." I went once a month for 6 months, never understood a word. But I'd come back to my group, and I would tell what I thought happened, whether it was right or not. Years later, I was intergroup representative again, and I began to understand again more. But it was a wonderful experience, wonderful experience. And later on, after I became delegate of 1977, 78, and 79, I was completely lost. I didn't know what to do with myself. And they needed a new intergroup chairman. So I put myself up for that job, and by golly, I got it. And I was first woman chairman of intergroup in Miami. So I congratulate you on your 15 years. And I heard the dedication in every one of you tonight that was introduced as participating in this great thing. Intergroup is so important. It is the hub in the Miami area, I know that. And I'm sure it's the hub here in Leesburg of your AA groups and your relationship with the general public. Now, I'm through. Are you? Thank you very much.